welcome to the opening episode of The State of Sports. You might recognize my voice here on Cliff Central. My name is Ben Karpinski. I spent many, many hours in the studio as a sporting fan and very happy to return, actually, because I feel with this podcast series, The State of Sport, we've got many great conversations to have. My first guest is Nobile Dlovu. Oops, how's it going?
Ben, how are you doing, man? Thanks so much for having me on here.
Well, I'm super happy to have you on here because The State of Sports, the podcast series, is going to be a wide variety of subjects. You know, the state of so many things from the live game, how fans interact with sport right now, the certain money issues. And that is where you come in here because you are the director of Cash and Sport,
yeah,
which you're going to tell me about in a second. But how the two of us know each other for some background here is that Nubs used to be the social media manager, the brains, the execution behind Betway's accounts. Now, if you understand sport, you understand that betting and betting companies are very entrenched in sport. They're very involved and they're very active. So take all of that, the knowledge that you must have in order to run a social media account for a betting company, I think gives you a very basic understanding about how accomplished my guest is today. Add on to that investigative journalist skills, a curiosity, and a huge sporting brain, and someone that probably knows more about football than I'll ever do, even if I had to dedicate the rest of my life to it. This is the man I have in front of me today.
Wow.
But it went so far that you were just not content by just having a job, so to speak. Cash and Sport. Now, this is heavy research. You are doing things. You are delving into the real state of sport out there from a business commercial aspect and obviously seeing what moves the needles. How did this come about and what made you start this?
Yeah. Just talk about an introduction.
Say that was off the cuff.
No, well, so Cash and Sport is interesting because it's literally, I try to make it seem as though I live at the intersection of cash and sport, hence the name. It came about in, I think it was about 2017 when I first started having the idea about doing it. At this time, I was working at Betway, as you said. Running the social media teams across the continent, which about 7 countries.
I think I messed that up. Totally downplayed it. You weren't just the manager, you were running the teams.
Yeah. So I had groups of employees in each country, and I would have to, you know, jump between all of the countries and make sure that things were working and making Betway the, you know, I wanted to make Betway the Colgate of betting companies, in that, you know, if you wanted to place a bet, people would ask you, are you placing a bet with Betway first before they ask you about any other company?
Sure.
And I think we achieved that. And I left in at the end of 2021. But, you know, this idea around Cash and Sport started basically in 2017 when I was very annoyed at the fact that I couldn't find any information about the business of sport, about who earns how much money in the Premier League, or, well, this was the Premier Soccer League at the time. Mm. And I couldn't find anything, really. So I actually put out a tweet about it at the end of 2017. And I said, okay, I'm going to set myself a challenge to be Africa's voice on the business of sport. I didn't really do anything about it in 2017. 2018 went by. And then in 2019, I met, that is now my, 2019 COVID comes around. I started putting out a little bit of research here and there, but nothing major. 2020, I met my wife, and she's an auditor and a CA, and she says, well, you know, you like these things. I can help you to understand the numbers side of it if you really want to get into it. And that's how it started. I started doing research on the owners of clubs in the Premier Soccer League and where they got their money from, and if I could find any reference to numbers, because a lot of these guys are tenderpreneurs. They make a lot of money from government contracts and so on. Those, because they have to be publicized, you know how much the government is paying them, so you could basically paint a picture of, you know, what the financial sustainability, my English daughter bundle's running out, what the financial sustainability of a club is by the virtue of understanding where these guys get their money, because most of our clubs are run by their owners. And that's where it started. And in 2021, at the end of 2021, I'd gotten so much attention, and a lot of people had come to me and said, well, you know, we pay people for this type of insight. Do you want to go and do it as a career? Took me a couple of months and said, okay, cool, let's do it. And that's where I am now. So for the past few months, this has been a full-on 24/7 research company that provides insights to a whole bunch of people that I can't really mention because of NDAs and stuff like that. But yeah, that's what I do now.
I always feel like there's a slight caveat with you because the information that is actually in your head, you can't always divulge.
Yeah.
But we'll get into that a little bit later. So one thing I really do admire about the stuff that I see on a week-to-week basis are the Twitter threads that you create. So on Twitter, Cash and then the letter N, Sport, Cash and Sport. That's where you are most prolific.
Yeah.
A lot must go into those things. And sorry, just prior to that, why I really want to chat to you and why I think you're so important in sport right now is that sport is under attack because it is so incredibly competitive. I think prior to COVID, where the fans' eyeballs were already so all over the place.
Yeah.
COVID then came. People were maybe less emotionally connected towards sports. We're talking the mainstream here because diehards like us will always find our sports and always support them.
Yeah.
But sport only grows and sport only lives when the general populace is really behind it, like all things on a mainstream level.
Yeah.
So I think what you do is that you legitimize sport a whole bunch more by trying to get more into what goes into it. And I think when you give brands and when you give companies an actual reason to get involved in sport, that's the actual lifeblood to it. So that is why I think this is so important. If we're just going to be, well, this tournament's every single year, these fans come and come to it, eventually people say, yeah, that's not enough.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we all have to play this role in, like, how do we build up sport? Because it is so much more than just guys running onto the field and then there's a score at the end.
Yeah.
And this is something that, you know, like, I used to be just the fanboy. So I used to love fans and that was me. I used to drink about 12 drafts a weekend and shout out and scream at TVs because, like any other person, that's what sport is. But it really is just, it's in the entertainment space now. So you got to compete with Netflix. You got to compete with pretty much everyone. Tom Cruise in a fighter jet. You are competing with everything that can grab your eyeballs.
Yeah.
So obviously now this is your full-time gig. This is something that you are working on all the time. How much, let's just go with a Twitter thread. Yesterday, I think it was last week I read something. It was very, very interesting. Your sort of research methods, do you have like certain sources that you are trusting? Is it all like kind of more in the journalism space where you talk to people individually?
Generally, I try not to be that guy that you know, I try not to be as journalistic. And for a very long time, as part of my threads, I would put out a disclaimer as the second tweet and say, I'm not a journalist. Because I think that journalists are trained, and I didn't want to be disrespectful to the art of journalism.
I think you're being too kind to the art of journalism nowadays.
But a lot of the stuff that I uncover is mostly desk research, where it's just hours going through. Sometimes you'll find dead links. I scroll through a lot of government websites and information that they put out there without knowing, you know, the ramifications of putting it out there. And obviously it's public information, right? We should know that information. I do have a number of people that send stuff to me, and say, listen, take a look at this. But if it's not publicly available and if it's stolen information, I generally don't use it. Let me not say stolen information, sort of, I guess maybe whistleblower type of stuff. I generally don't use it because one, I don't want to get sued. Two, you never know what agendas people may have, and they would feed you information which is, you know, problematic.
Yeah,
so I generally try and...
There's generally a lot of can of worms you don't want to kind of open in this.
Yeah, I generally try to keep it PC, but, you know, the problem that we have on the continent, and not just South Africa, because I want, you know, the business is an Africa-focused business, not South Africa-focused. Generally, we have a problem in that we don't document enough what we're doing. Like, for instance, I put out a series of a thread yesterday about Morocco and the, you know, sports tourism and why all of a sudden Morocco seems to be the go-to place for hosting, you know, CAF fixtures and games. And people were surprised to know that in Morocco's been doing this since 1980. It's not something that just happened.
Yeah.
But the problem is that no one's ever written something about it to say, okay, this is the full picture. And we don't do that enough.
Well, I recommend reading this thread because I'll go right to the end. What I love about it is that you did document it chronologically and what has happened. But right at the end, there was something quite chilling about it. You said that South Africa couldn't host something because of electricity vulnerability.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons why we couldn't, one of the reasons why we failed to host is there were two main reasons, basically. The one is that we was at 50% capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is we just can't keep the lights on. If you were watching that game, I think it was the Pumas a few weeks ago.
The Currie Cup against Western Province.
Yeah, that's a problem. If you can't maintain just the basics, just like electricity, how can you expect it to attract international level events?
I mean, it made for a funny sports clip on SuperSport, but ultimately it's hugely embarrassing sport drops out the lights.
Yeah, and I didn't say anything about it because fine, it's funny and people are laughing about it, but that image says to you that this country is not ready to host. And this is part of the reason why, if you're going to talk about, and we'll probably talk about it later, about hosting international events, those things are what gives, you know, your country a lot of eyeballs, and gives, you know, gives you a lot of attention when you want, you know, a lot of people to come to your country.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think, look, I've got about 100 different topics that I'd love to throw at you and get some insights around. Let's start with hosting events. Rugby World Cup.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say it. I think we were absolutely done over by the French, Billy Beaumont or whoever it was. Mm-hmm. The 2023 World Cup, I think, was very much, should have been South Africa when you consider the amount of trophies we've won, the impact we have in world rugby and our ability to host. Although your last comments about electricity just completely ruined my argument.
Yeah.
But so anyway, moving right on from there, South Africa, then World Rugby announced the fact that it'll be Australia and obviously North America
mm-hmm.
will be the next host. So there's your next two World Cups taken care of. Massive uproar from the local fans here saying, what about South Africa?
Yeah.
Now, am I right in saying that we didn't even bid for those Rugby World Cups?
Yeah, so in 2017, we were the preferred candidate alongside France and Ireland. We were the best, basically. Our score was higher than both of them. Our problem is that, and just to explain to listeners, Rugby World Cup, 80% of the revenue for World Rugby comes from the Rugby World Cup. A large chunk of that revenue comes from these tournament fees that World Rugby charges countries to host. We put out a fee, a guaranteed fee of about 220 million. Well, they take it in pounds, so all of these numbers are going to be in pounds. It was about 220 million that we had guaranteed. France guaranteed 500 million.
Wow.
So it's a lot more money. And that basically, if you look at the numbers, World Rugby is always going to say, well, we need a surplus in order to survive.
Wait, sorry, hang on a second. So that guarantee, is that money post-tournament that the French are
They guarantee it prior to the tournament. If it starts, it's part of their bid package. So they put it together as part of a bid package and say, we will pay you a guaranteed fee of 200 million or 500 million. They also then said to World Rugby that they would pay, that they would buy the broadcast and image rights for that tournament, so that World Rugby doesn't have to then go and try and find media partners and so on and so on. The French would buy it, and then they would have to try and go and find broadcast partners and so on and so on to commercialize it. So out of pocket, the French already had 500 million out of pocket. So now they have to try and make that money back.
But then World Rugby has two tournaments, essentially, if you look at those numbers, because, I mean, it was essentially double what Surf was going to give them.
But whoever bids, that's why the French won the bid, right?
Well, that's a very short conversation then, of course.
Yeah, that's why the French won the bid.
That is a staggering amount of money.
And if you look at the US bid for their World Cup that they're putting up together with Canada, I think that's going to be the North America one. 500 million, that's what they've pledged. So already, I mean, if the minimum that World Rugby requires as a minimum pledge is 120, South Africa puts up 200 and France puts up 500, we're not going to get that World Cup.
Okay,
you know, it's a simple economics thing.
Now, do you know what Australia then did? Because that, to me, was a very surprised choice. Again, I wasn't privy to the knowledge you just shared with me right now. So I don't see why Australia should get it on any level. Firstly, it's like a fourth sport in winter. I don't think it's a really good country to have it because you've got Perth on the one side, Sydney on the other. That's a very big difference. There's a lot of reasons why it shouldn't go there. What do they cough up on?
How would they get that much money? Yeah, I didn't look at what Australia provided as a guarantee. But part of the reasons why we also didn't get it was the reasons that we'd spoken about earlier prior to, you know, getting into the numbers, which is instability with regards to just being able to sustain electricity and just being a country that's able to host. And then obviously our government said, well, you know, we can't really support the bid financially. So that's part of the reason why we pulled out.
So I get that you've got to put the guarantees up, but then going through the hoops to get there, I mean, how costly is that in regard to?
Well, it costs a lot of money just to bid in the first place.
Is this money that's going to Rugby World Cup?
Yeah.
So like World Rugby again?
Yeah, so in 1995, right, there were fees. So there's minimum fees that you have to put together. In 1995, when we hosted the tournament, costs were £10.6 million pounds. 1999, when Wales hosted, £25 million pounds. 2003, when Australia hosted, £62.3 million. And then France, after that, was £133 million. So the tournament costs have been going up incrementally a lot.
Feels like the French keep kicking this up far too long.
Yeah, they do, but they, at the end of the day, the euro will always trump the rand, and that's that.
I totally get that, but you know, World Rugby have this sort of obligation to obviously further the game, globalize things. Yeah. Like everyone has to.
This is why they took it to Japan, right? But Japan again, Japan got it for the first time. They also threw up, I think it was more in the region of 300 million or something to that effect.
Sure.
So again, they provided the financial guarantees. They had the stadiums because, you know, the stadiums were already there. They knew at the time that, you know, they've got a pretty good team. So they wouldn't have had an issue with regards to getting the fans to watch.
Sure.
Because that's also another problem, right, is that you could have a World Cup, but how many people are actually playing rugby? How many people are watching? It's a problem if you then can't get it broadcast to enough people around the world so that you can actually make money, because broadcast fees are a huge component as well. Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of things that come into it. But ultimately, we should have won it. Time zone-wise, we're perfectly placed. It came down to money, basically.
I just get the impression that then means only certain countries are going to host World Cups going forward.
We're not going to see a World Cup in South Africa probably for the next... Well, we know for sure that we're not going to see one for the next 15 or so years.
Mm.
It's not going to happen, in my opinion, unless economically this country picks up. We're not going to see another World Cup for another 50 years, probably.
Yeah, but again, I'm not even going to be emotional and try fudge on that. Those guarantees, that's business. And again, World Rugby, they sell things. I know we were involved, my agency Retroactive, we're involved in trying to source some rights to certain footage.
Mm.
You understand where these guys make big margins. It is ridiculous. Together with like IMG and those kind of companies, it is a business, and it's a big business. And they really do capitalize on these kind of things. And so be it. I mean, if we were at the head there, we were doing this, we would be a failure at our jobs.
Yeah, absolutely.
But to get into a slightly more positive space with regards to local rugby in South Africa, the United Rugby Championship.
Yeah.
As a Stormers fan, obviously, I've been loving this tournament.
Mm.
It is finally a tournament where they've been pretty good. Mm. But, you know, you just said that we're perfectly positioned time zone. I was hugely for this amalgamation with the Northern Hemisphere.
Mm.
New Zealand can go be smug by themselves with the Pacific Islanders and the Australians. I really don't care.
Yeah.
Do you think this is going to be the financial sort of boom that we might need, considering that there are other like things at play here? Obviously, hosting World Cups, that's not going to really help. The conversation's done in my mind.
Mm.
Is the URC going to be something that's really going to help springboard rugby, considering that when you watch that documentary series, Two Sides, it was kind of revealed recently that if the Lions tour didn't happen, SARU might just be no longer.
Yeah.
So, firstly and foremost, like, can you verify that? And secondly, is the United Rugby Championships and the move up north going to be the sort of financial lifeline that we hope it will be?
I do think so, for sure. Last week, I spoke to Edward Kutsia, the CEO at the Sharks, and he mentioned that just from the fan fest, they held a fan fest, and we'll talk about fans later. after the FanFest, that game that they played against Leinster, which happened, I think, 2 weeks after the floods happened.
Right.
They had 30% more fans in the stadium. Their attendance numbers for every other game after that also increased. So they've had, in terms of numbers of fans in the stadium, more now in 2022, regardless of floods and all of these things that have happened in KZN, than they had in the previous 5 years on average. So the numbers of fans watching are increasing. It's absolutely correct that had we not hosted the Lions series, SA Rugby would have been in a world of trouble. I looked at the numbers prior to that event, and SA Rugby, if I'm not mistaken, I think we were looking at something in the order of R1 billion in terms of economic impact. Wow. Just from the Lions series alone.
Does that include the fans and tourism and those kind of things?
Yeah. Obviously, as a result of fans not being allowed, we lost out on a huge amount of money.
Massively.
But if you're talking about R300 million in revenue from broadcasts and so on and so on, it's massive. And you know, if you're looking at that event on its own, and then you go and you look at what maybe let's say CVC, Silver Lake, paid for their stake in the All Blacks, for instance,
right,
where they paid $130 million. You know, it's not a huge amount of money if in the grand scheme of things, but you know, it's substantial. It's a substantial amount. I think I'd have to go and check the actual figures. I think we made something in the region of about 200 to 300 million in revenue from the Lions series alone. And it was much needed, because if it didn't happen, we wouldn't have had support for the likes of the Cheetahs, who have been in financial trouble, the EP Kings, who've been in financial trouble, just lost a CEO last week when Thando Manana left. It would have been disastrous for South African rugby. And to answer your initial question, do I think that the United Rugby Championship will be beneficial? Just look at the mechanics. Let's not even look at the numbers. If you watch a Premier League game, you can watch a Premier League game all the way until 8 p.m. from 1 p.m. in the afternoon.
Sure.
If you're trying to watch a game in New Zealand, you have to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
How many people are up at that time? It just doesn't make any sense. So I was always for the move to play north-south instead of south-east. Mm-hmm. New Zealand and Australia, I think, will definitely suffer for this. One, the level of competition is not the same without the Springbok teams, without South African teams. And then two, because we have so many South Africans already playing in the Northern Hemisphere, people want to watch those teams anyway. Those guys want to watch us. So there's a lot more broadcast revenue coming. Sky, and BT and all of these other broadcasters in the Northern Hemisphere have a lot more money than the broadcasters sitting in New Zealand and Australia anyway. So
it goes back to your whole thing about the euro. It's always going to win. Those foreign currencies are always going to win.
It's always going to win.
And then if we can somehow, again, I'm jumping again, if we can somehow be part of the whole Six Nations mix, because obviously there's big talk around that, that's also an absolute no-brainer. That's financial certainty for...
It's a no-brainer. And looking at the success of the URC right now, in terms of revenue and people watching, for them in Europe, they want South Africa to be in there. It doesn't make any sense not to.
Well, especially with World Rugby trying to have these sort of watered-down World Cup structures. They do it so well in football with that Nations League, whatever.
Yes,
I say do it so well. I think they're clogging this year's fixtures up far too much.
Yes, too many games.
Far too many. Even the guys are playing a World Cup in December.
Far too many games. And they're playing now. It's crazy.
It's like, I'm sure, like test your squad and all that kind of stuff. But no, there's got to be levels here. I could probably chat to you about for like 7 hours and about rugby in general, because I have many theories about New Zealand, how they shot themselves in the foot. But we must move on. There's a big rumbling in golf right now around money. There are so many different talking points. Phil Mickelson was essentially cancelled, ostracized, thrown out into the scrap heap of sporting legends because of his certain comments. Look, Phil plays it fast and loose in every single way, shape, and form. We've known this from his gambling background to the way he plays golf. His comments around the PGA Tour, which, and then he was trying to leverage the Saudi-backed tour to then get it on over the, I don't know, it was all very murky.
Yeah.
Yesterday he put out a statement by basically saying he's taking some time off away from the game. I mean, he didn't even defend the PGA champs, the major that he won. And he has committed to the LIV, Saudi-backed new golf league, essentially. Yeah. Now, if you don't know what this is, this is Greg Norman and a whole bunch of Saudi-backed money. It's come together. They're offering fantastic guarantees. I mean, there is talk that Dustin Johnson is going to get $120 million to be a part of this. Now, bear in mind, Tiger Woods, the greatest golfer of all time. Sorry, Jack, but that's true. He made $121 million, I think, his entire career. Dustin Johnson is going to get that.
Up front, yeah.
To be a breakaway in this thing.
Phil Mickelson is reportedly going to earn $200 million to be part of it. There's no cut. So every golfer will make some sort of money.
Yeah, I hate no cut events. They're boring.
At the very least, $250,000.
That is just staggering, staggering money. And for many would say, well, they're rich golfers. Why do they need the money? Surely they'd play the prestigious events.
Well, the question is, are they actually rich golfers? So for most players who are not on the PGA Tour,
right?
Because that's most players.
Yeah,
the PGA Tour is a very exclusive club, right? There's very few players who can play on the PGA Tour. For every other golfer out there that is not on the PGA Tour and that plays on the European Tour, or let's come back home and talk about the Sunshine Tour, those players are the independent contractors, right?
Yeah.
So you pay your own flights, your own accommodation, you pay for your trainer, you pay for your caddy, you pay for your own food. You pay tax. Now, if you're going to make let's say the top earner on the Sunshine Tour last year made 2.6 million rand.
That was a bumper season.
That was a bumper season, right? Minus all of those costs. Your revenue comes to maybe 1.3 million.
Yeah.
So you've lost half of your revenue already.
Let's just really break it down for salary purposes. Say you're making 100,000 rand a month.
Yeah. If you're making 100,000 rand a month, you're coming out with less than, it's about 42 maybe, let's say 43K a month. That's after all of your payments and all of your expenses, and there could be even more. Now, not every player is sponsored, so you could get a sponsorship deal that provides you with kit, with clubs, and so on and so on. But if you don't have that, you have to buy your own clubs. You have to buy your own clothes.
Yeah, I mean, look,
own balls.
I think when it comes to the Saudi League, I mean, like, again, it's not a podcast in itself, how difficult to be a golf pro, because a lot of the guys are losing money every single month.
Yeah.
I think a golf pro I spoke to recently, he said something along the lines of, you are going to spend 40,000 rand a week if you want to play on the DP World Tour. When you consider all the things you said there, that's what's going to cost them. So if you're not making a cut, you're 40K in the red.
40K in the hole.
In the hole.
And that's just...
And you're on the road for a month.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're looking like... Anyway, different conversation, yeah. But
in any case, if we go back to the LIV Tour.
Yes.
The LIV Tour itself, in and of itself, right, I think is very interesting. I agree with Greg Norman's assertion that these guys are independent contractors. They can't be... It's not the UFC, where they're forced to fight in the UFC.
Well, that was my very next question, because the PGA are saying there'll be sanctions involved.
Yeah, but how do you sanction them? Like, exactly. Is it illegal for a player to go and play somewhere else?
It's not. Well, I think they're basically going to be playing, calling some bluffs in this one here.
Yeah. So
just to be clear, the PGA Tour do not have authority over where these guys go and play.
They don't.
You don't get like a PGA Tour card that says, well done, you are now playing PGA Tour events.
Yeah. You qualify, and sometimes I would invite you to play onto the PGA Tour. You would get a wild card entry or whatever it is, but you could play on other tours. So what's the difference between this one and that one? The only difference is that it's at the top level. It's targeting the top players. You've got Sergio Garcia, you've got Dustin Johnson, Martin Keimer, blah blah blah. All of these guys have been top level golfers who've won tournaments on the PGA Tour and been right up there on the PGA Tour. They're now choosing to go and play at a tournament where they're guaranteed money. They're guaranteed a lot more money than they would have earned on the PGA Tour. And the PGA Tour doesn't like it because it's threatening their existence. And then they're using these guys chopped off and, you know, they killed a journalist, and absolutely right. But if the money had come from somewhere else, and not the Saudis, what would they be saying?
Yeah,
the conversation would be very different.
It's quite funny. There are some double standards here, and there's no doubting the Saudi history on this. Something that I do find interesting is that, I mean, ultimately, you start playing professional. Professional means you want to make some money.
Yeah.
You know, someone like Louis Oosthuizen, I can't see why he would want to do this. Because the PGA Tour is good, he makes good money, and he wants to play and try and win big, prestigious events. But then I also look at it, it's like, as fans get so carried away with the emotion of this kind of stuff, this guy's got kids, he's got a horse ranch, he wants time with them. So rather than hacking for 30 weeks of the year when he's trying to get these wins, trying to make this money, the Saudis are going, okay, so you can play 10 events, and we'll guarantee you best case scenario money-wise. So he's looking at this and going, okay, so what you're telling me is I've got an extra 20 weeks with my family. Yeah, thanks.
For more money. Exactly.
And I totally get it. So, but like, this is my big question. This one is that, is it sustainable? There's obviously a huge runway of money that's going into this kind of thing. Like all startups, okay? You say to yourself, cool, we got money for, say, 3 years. We're going to bankroll this thing. We're going to see it go. I don't see these events being that entertaining. I don't think the fields are good enough. This whole no-cut business means there's nothing to play for on. One of the best things in golf is watching Friday afternoon, where you know a guy's got to get two or three birdies coming in to like to make money because there's urgency. If everyone's got no cut, it's like it's almost exhibition-like.
Yeah, no, I hear you on the sustainability part, but I think what they're trying to do is first and foremost establish the event and make sure that it actually get a field of players who want to play, and then as event gets bigger, you start introducing more traditional rules such as a cut, but then also ensure that the players who do get cut earn some money regardless of where they finish.
Well, that's what the hardest thing about golf is, the fact that you can do this for 2 days and you make zero.
It's very difficult. And I completely understand why players are saying, but this gives me a little bit more freedom and I'm a little bit more secure, because they're not secure on the PGA Tour. It costs a huge amount of money just to be there.
Well, if you were to take away Ricky Fowler's commercial prowess, and he was just a golfer, that guy would be checking what he's spending money on right now.
It would be very difficult.
He was a top 10 golfer competing all the majors. Now he's really just, he's trying to find something. If he makes a cut, it's a big week. Take away all the endorsements, that guy would jump at this thing. The first opportunity.
And how many players actually are endorsed commercially? Actually make money off of the golf course? That's not a lot.
It's not a lot.
So even with players that are on the PGA Tour, basically almost all of those players are endorsed, right? But those endorsement deals don't always include money. And when they do just include kit or whatever it is, it makes it difficult. Some players obviously are paid to play. Tiger Woods and the top pros are paid money. I think Tiger was paid $3 million just to play in Turkey at some point. Tiger's caddy was one of the richest sportsmen in New Zealand at some point, and he was a caddy.
Tiger's caddy used to have like his own less car hobby funded by the fact that he was carrying this dude's bag.
Yeah, true, but that's 1%.
Yeah, no, it is
1% of the players. But
so,
anyway, yeah,
so all those people. Sorry. All those people that you mentioned there, they bring the audience. So my misgivings towards this thing is like, will it be sustainable after the stage? Maybe the money will never run out, much like the oil. Who knows? That's a different business model altogether.
Financially speaking, it's very sustainable for the Saudis because they've got bottomless. It's bottomless, and they know that sport is a very good avenue for them to push a certain agenda. That's why I look at Newcastle, for instance. That's not a 2 day or 2 year play. That's 10, 15 years.
You know, some people call it sport washing because they're looking to improve the global image, looking to push sports tourism.
I mean,
it's not just some guys like, hey, money, golf, cool, let's do this.
What's the current image of Qatar after Manchester City and PSG? And people don't really talk about Qatar in a negative sense anymore.
No, I mean, the articles are there, but it's like,
they've achieved exactly what they wanted to do.
Precisely.
So
I want to speak audience, because if you don't have the audience, you're not going to make the big bucks. Correct. I think that's one of the dynamics around sport that you cannot get away from. And there's two parts where I want to take this section of the conversation. Firstly, the Forbes Top 50 comes out. It's always the kind of use, the same names are towards the top and made up of it. American dominated because American sport has always been that much further ahead. Mm. When you look how entrenched sports and industries like baseball, basketball, NFL, even hockey players to that degree. So 35 of the top 50 are all American based. Now, we can obviously gloss over the usual suspects there. But the one name in the top 50 I found so interesting in a business and cash and sport kind of sense is that Jake Paul is in the top 50.
Mm.
Jake Paul was a YouTuber slash content creator at the cusp of where this was really rising. He built a huge audience of teens that watch him do anything.
Mm.
I was too old for that. But then he decided, hey, I want to box. What is that about? He made his own boxing business, essentially.
Yeah.
He calls people out. He fights them. He is very smart how he does this because he calls MMA fighters out.
Mm.
Now, if you don't know, if a boxer is to fight anyone in a bar, a boxer basically wins because of the skill set involved. MMA, in the MMA setting, will rip someone apart, sure. But if you're looking to knock someone out in the confines of boxing, one-on-one exchanges, a boxer will always win. So he knows. He's almost like hedged his bets there.
Mm.
So he's got in there, and he's proven the theory that sport is just pure entertainment, and he's making huge money. What are your thoughts on that guy? And again, do you think this is kind of a sustainable way of going about it? Because he's offering, quite like the Saudis, guaranteed money that hardworking fighters aren't getting.
Mm.
And that in itself is like his business model now.
Yeah. I've got mixed feelings about this one. On the one hand, I completely understand the business model. It's a brilliant business model. And I've said this for a while, but sport can't just be about come in, play, and leave. Fans want a lot more than that, and I think America's the holy grail of that. Entertainment and sport married together.
Well, if you just look what the UFC did, they were the ones that during COVID were like, we have to go back, we are going to go back, and they're an entertainment company like no other. It's actually my favorite sport. Yeah. I'm a kid that grew up on rugby, cricket, and golf. MMA is my favorite sport.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd say that, but I mean, that's me.
Yeah, but it's entertaining, right?
Sure.
But what Jake Paul has done is he's taken the online digital audience, right, which is captive and engaged, and he's taken that and he's married it with the traditional boxing audience. Because when he says he wants to fight Floyd Mayweather or whatever, the boxing audience is like, Floyd is 40 years old, he's going to rip this guy apart. And Jake Paul takes his millennials and is like,
well, so that was his brother that fought Mayweather.
No, what's his Logan. Yeah, Logan. Yeah. But I mean, the strategy is the same, right?
Yeah.
If he wants to fight Tyrone Woodley, for instance, right, who he knocked out, you know, the traditional fan is going to be like, easy fight for Woodley, blah, blah, blah. And then he knocks him out, it's like, okay, well. And then he does it again, and he does, I mean, how many, you know, so for him, I think the business model makes perfect sense. Where it highlights some serious problems is in sports like boxing, for instance, where boxing is kind of dying as a sport in that the number of stars is dwindling. You don't get there's so many, it's so fragmented. There's WBA, WNBC, blah 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 blah. There's like 20 different federations.
Far too many.
You never see the best of the best fighters fighting against each other. So you lose that star attraction because you just don't know who the star is anymore because there's so many guys claiming to be. But overall, I think that it speaks to where sport is going in terms of just audiences. Kids are watching online. The numbers of people that are playing, you know, on Twitch or whatever is gigantic in comparison to the traditional sports audience. And sport is moving away from just your traditional broadcast models, and they're now providing OTT platforms where people can watch fights on Twitch, and there's someone talking along or whatever it is. I think I've got mixed feelings around the legitimacy of this and how far it can go, because there's only so many celebrity fighters or celebrity fights that you can have before people are like, this is a fad.
Yeah. So, well, basically, he has to fight a boxer next.
Yeah, he has to fight someone.
I know he's trying to fight Tommy Fury.
Yeah, but that's not Tommy Fury is not for me. For me, Tommy Fury is not. And this is why I'm saying there's so many people there's only so many people that you can fight.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, he needs stock essentially, like anyone he's trying to sell.
Yeah.
And I think Dana White is like, this isn't good for our business. Mm. because I think a great fight would be Jorge Masvidal against Jake Paul. It'd be a great fight. It really will be. But again, it's like going back to the contracts. It's one of those evolving things. I think it's been good in that it's also shown fighter pay in MMA. That was one of his big things.
Yeah,
it's like you don't pay these guys enough.
Yeah,
and I think the whole thing about being paid enough is a huge argument in so many different ways. Again, you go back to like what's the audience.
Mm.
So Francis Ngannou was getting paid. I think he gets like $600,000 for a fight as a heavyweight champion of the UFC.
Mm.
Tyson Fury gets over 10, 20, whatever.
That's 20 million.
Yeah, that's material. Yeah. So, but then you work it back. Okay, so but is Francis Ngannou's audience as big as say, I don't know, Usman? Kamaru Usman, I would say probably not.
Yeah.
Is as big as Israel Adesanya?
Yeah,
for a fact, it's not.
Mm.
So going into audiences and direct pay, there's been some sort of landmark sort of progress being made with the gender pay gap.
Yeah.
Now, this is a huge argument, which I've been involved in various stages throughout. Mm. And Ronda Rousey was quoted in saying that women should get paid for what they bring to the table.
Mm.
As in, like, if your audience is huge, she's a great example. She got into the MMA scene. She was the first woman superstar in the UFC.
Mm.
Her pay-per-view was huge.
Yeah.
She then took that to WWE as a wrestler. Again, huge audience, makes huge amounts of money. I think that the biggest case for the gender gap in sport that's just not on whatsoever is football, soccer, as the Americans call it.
Soccer.
The men's team doesn't win World Cups. The men's team gets paid four times, perhaps, as much as the women's team. The women's team are World Cup champions.
Yes.
When you look at FIFA World Cup final audience stats, they're actually pretty big on the women's side. People always go, oh, more guys, more people watch the men's all around.
Yeah.
Well, not always, because America doesn't watch the FIFA World Cup because the men's team's nowhere in it.
Yeah.
America watches from the women's place, so the numbers are huge. The
numbers are massive.
Anyway, we could wax lyrically on the numbers and this kind of stuff. What's your take on, is this more of an emotional subject or is this more of a business subject when you consider this? In that, I think the women's American football team is almost an anomaly in this space. Mm. A lot of the time, they deserve exactly what it is. How are audiences kind of, I'm really butchering this as a question, but how are audiences assessed in a financial level to make the right amount, who gets what? And do you think that there's a scientific process behind that that's just not being, what's just being flouted by administrators?
Mm.
Or is that something that needs a lot more work until we actually fully understand what women athletes are really worth?
Yeah, I think the answer to that question comes in a different space, not necessarily the audiences. Generally, when sponsorships or broadcast agreements have been agreed, generally the broadcast agreement would include the women's element in the men's element. So let's say, for instance, you pay a sponsorship fee for the Springboks, they would just bundle the women's game in it, and then say, we'll pay you a flat fee for rugby, you know, or whatever. Nowadays, what started to happen is that federations and rights holders have started unbundling those deals or those revenue streams and saying, we want our women's team to have their own revenue stream. We want our men's team to have their own revenue stream.
Okay, smart.
Now, it's a difficult play because you're coming from nowhere and saying, well, value what the women's rugby team is worth, whereas value what the Springboks rugby team is worth.
Sure.
And sponsors, FIFA's even created a whole new category for FIFA women leading up to the World Cup, where Visa's a sponsor, and they want to have women's sports as a standalone thing so that, you know, we can actually see properly where the value is.
Mm.
Our problem is that because sports rights have been bundled for so long, it's very difficult to understand what the true value of women's sport is or what it has been over the years. Now, to answer your question, I don't think it's a – I think the major opportunity for anyone in sport right now is women's sport, because male sport has such a saturation level that, you know, the growth is very minimal, whereas in women's sport, you put your money in women's sport, they output – they perform, you know. Let's not forget that for a long time, a lot of these women's sport athletes had to be a good friend of ours, Sanani, while she was playing, she had a bursary fee, but a lot of the players that she was playing with were also fully employed. So how are you going to be performing at your highest level when you also have a job at the same time?
Totally.
So it was almost impossible for these players to perform at the highest level. But then if you go and look at the World Cup and what these American women are doing, New Zealand women are doing, these just Dutch women are doing, Vivian Miedema, actually the striker for Arsenal, is, geez, man, she's an outstanding player. So if you look at the stats and the numbers, women's sport is growing far faster than men's sport, right? But can you pay the same amount? Probably not. But they're making a very good case for you to start paying them a lot more than what you were paying them before.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that I will never have a problem with. I think it's such an interesting point that people have this, what you said about unbundling those kind of things. It's like there's so many old conventional ways of thinking about women's sports.
Yeah.
And I feel like once that falls away, we'll get a much better semblance of what it is.
Yeah.
My biggest talking point around this is that, again, this could be a very sort of maybe crude way of looking at it, but I don't think enough women watch women's sport to really drive that huge amount of growth that will get it to the
But the problem parity. Also is people don't watch. People can only watch sport when it's there for them to watch. If you're going to have a Bafana Bafana game on SABC1, right, and then you're going to have a Banyana Banyana game, which is delayed live, you can't then complain when people aren't able to watch the game. Or you can't complain when the game's only available on YouTube. You know, we have to give the amount of airtime required, to, you know, because the men's game didn't get to where it is now by mistake.
There's absolutely no competition.
The games were broadcast and people started watching. Broadcast the games and people will watch. And the numbers have proven it. You know, the women's games are watched. It's just obviously not at the same level, but you're starting from a lower base in any case. Sure. So I think if we open up the industry more, give women's sport a little bit more of an opportunity in that it actually gets airtime and it gets it's put in front of people's screens and so on and so on. People will watch. It's just, I think, and as weird as this may sound, it's a little bit early to say whether the conversation about equal pay is justified, because we've bundled the rights for so long. We actually don't know what the true value is of women's sport. It's difficult to say. In America, it's very easy because, I mean, yeah, for a long time I've thought that women's team should be getting paid more. I mean, they attract higher audience numbers. Sure. They win big competitions. Very simple, you know.
Okay, well, there's definitely to be continued in that. But like we said, it's too early. It's too early to see, and the sweeping suggestions that come onto it maybe aren't founded just yet. Obilin Ndlovu, thank you so much for your time today. We have to get out of the studio. It's been a great first episode of The State of Sports, and I, for one, have known more about the state of cash in sports thanks to you. Follow him on Twitter, Cash in Sports, so the letter N. And also, you got a podcast, right?
Yeah, but it needs to come back. I've been so lazy. I haven't had time to create a whole bunch of content. But yeah, it's coming back soon. So yeah, Cash in Sport on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. Those are the main platforms.
Cool. And you can catch me on Twitter @FollowTheBounce. And more of The State of Sports will be coming to you soon. Thank you very much.